Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Woordfeest 2016 and specifically the H.B. Tom Theatre. It is my honour to introduce the guests today. Now, Claire Robertson is the author of The Spiral House, winner of the 2014 Sunday Times Fiction Prize and a South African Literary Award and shortlisted for the University of Johannesburg Debut Prize. She lives in Simonstown. Michiel Haynes grew up in various towns and cities all over South Africa and studied at the universities of Stellenbosch and Cambridge. He lectured in English at the University of Stellenbosch until 2003, when he took retirement to write full-time. Apart from a book on the 19th century novel and many critical essays, he has published 7 novels and several translations, the latest of which is Ingrid Winterbach's It Might Get Loud. He is at present working on a new novel and a translation of Ingrid Winterbach's Vlakwater. Please welcome them.
Thanks very much. Wow, Claire, yes, we've been, I don't want to say at loggerheads before, but we have faced each other before. I hope this is going to be as pleasant as the last time. In fact, I'm sure it will be. Now, both your novels have been historical novels. The Spiral House was set in late 18th century, beginning...
1795 and 1961.
And the mid-20th century. And this one is set from, is it 1901? Or is it
About late 1901 up until, we just nick 1948.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to come back to that very interesting time span. But what I want to ask you first is, why are you attracted to historical novels?
I didn't know that I was. It was the weirdest
thing. Seem to.
Yeah. The first one just sucked me in to The Spiral House, to the story of a freed slave re-encountering slavery. I just thought it was an interesting thing to do. This one, also, I'd been reading and I encountered something. And the third book that I'm busy with at the moment, I had it all planned out. It was this right up to the minute South African contemporary novel, and it was so cool, etc. And I just got ambushed, whoosh, by a Victorian novel in South Africa.
South African Victorian
in Natal. And if I look back, I have always read a lot about South African history. My pet project that I'm always working on in the back of my mind is a history of sex in South Africa, because we have we do have some history. The way we express ourselves in law and thou shalt not and all of the things. Anyway, just...
Well, that enters into this, doesn't it? Into this novel.
Well, I did. I indulged myself in the middle section of this book with an entirely ludicrous approach to sexuality on the part of the British. Well, the British and then a British missionary who wants to regulate how people go about their business. And I can't answer the... Part of me is a bit reluctant to say, well, I'm a writer of historical fiction, because it paints a picture in my mind of a writer that I don't quite recognize. I guess it's a Georgette Heyer. I should be so lucky as to write as well as Georgette Heyer.
Hilary Mantel.
No. That's the redemption. If Hilary Mantel can do it and make these miraculous books like she's done.
Well, the thing I think is the point that someone made about Hilary Mantel is it's extremely well researched. It's historically, one believes, very accurate, and yet it reads like a modern novel. The issues are modern, the people are modern, their mindsets are modern. And do you feel that about your characters? I don't want to commit myself on it. In other words, do you feel yourself making concessions, saying no one in 1930 could have thought like that, or do you find yourself imposing something of your own mindset on your character?
I tie myself into the most terrible knots trying to realize what people could have known. There's a wonderful book that I found called Pattern of Expectation, and it sets out what people thought the future would be like in various times, from late 17th century right the way up to about the mid-200s, 2000s. And it is fascinating. It's very brief, the historical period. If I go back, I think, 200 or 300 years in the first book. That's not very long in the passage of things. And I try while trying to imagine they would or wouldn't have thought that that I'm also battling against 21st century chauvinism, that we think we're so clever and we've sorted out so much now, and we really haven't. We're still struggling with the same things, and we still are basic mammals at the end of it. Yeah. But the third book that I'm busy with at the moment, I'm toying with more of an authorial intervention, as grand as that sounds, in that who are we kidding if we say that it's not being read by 21st century people who all share a certain mindset? So why not include that?
But are you using then a voice that is 21st century sussed up? In other words, someone who says, well, we of course know this couldn't be like this. In other words, is the authorial voice standing here, or is the authorial voice coeval with the...
All I know is that it's interjecting the where we think we've reached in terms of, and me also as a woman in my 50s, where we think we've reached in terms of human motive and understanding, expressed in the idiom of the day. I'm quite strict about that.
Idiom of that day.
Okay, yeah. Right, no. Okay. And in fact, in the Magistrate of Gower, close readers will notice. It starts sort of 1902, so Edwardian. Mm. It goes to a little bit of history in high Victorian language, quite deliberately. Mm. Slips into the 1920s, and then the 30s were the hardest to get because they're too close to us, and then there's not a great Gatsby to deal with in that. There's no clear touchstones, cultural touchstones to work out how to do it. So I just made them. I found the most wonderful source. I love the internet to bits. In the 30s, there was a South African singer called Yusuf Marais who just, I don't know how well known he was. He translated a lot.
I wasn't around, but
you may have heard stories. He translated a lot of Afrikaans folk songs into English and had quite a hit in America with these. Okay. And this very pure, very sweet sort of his idiom was I tried to use in the 30s.
Okay. Mm. Did you find yourself, since many of your characters are in fact Afrikaans speaking, did you find yourself adapting English to what you regard as Afrikaans speech rhythms?
I did that a lot in the first book, the 1961 period. I would almost write it in my head in Afrikaans and then change it, because they are... It's the closest you get to exotic and interesting for me, anyway, in this country. Not the closest. In what I was dealing with, it was irresistible. I couldn't stay away from those sort of rhythms because they are so beautiful, and it's such a playing around with language, a language playing around with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, trying to put the verb at the end of the sentence.
It's quite a precarious thing, you know.
You don't want parody. My goodness, that would be terrible.
I admire Alan Paton's, in Too Late the Fella Rope, but some people do object that what he's doing there, he's sort of writing what he regards as an English version of the Afrikaans. Some people find it awfully phony, but I like it.
I was so worried about giving offence with this Magistrate of Gower because, I stomped around saying, well, I'm South African, I can write myself into being Dingaan's daughter if I want, but you really can't. It's very obvious that you're imagining in a social context that is not entirely, we're not Simunya, we are not one yet. Mm-hmm. And I was a bit worried about that. But of the main character, Henry Force, the things I liked best about him were what you would call Afrikaans things, his generosity of spirit, his humor. And that was an important part of the book, that he's both so of his people and both personally, internally, and externally with the politics of the day, feels himself rejected or that he cannot be part of it. But he's such a wonderful exemplar. If you're getting towards if there's a lesson in the book, it's not so much that the people who are excluded who suffer, it's the place that excludes them. It's the village that cuts out its best and its brightest in that way. That's who suffers.
Yeah. Now that's very central to a line I want to follow up on.
Sorry, I'm rushing ahead with
you. No, you're here to rush. I mean, I'm not here to stop
perhaps
you.
Perhaps to natter.
Okay. If we look at the title, The Magistrate of Gower, what we have is a, call it a creative tension between the individual the magistrate and the place, Gaur, but the individual is there in terms of his job. It's not Henry Foster.
And a respected position in this place called Gaur. Yeah.
So what came first to you, the concept of Gaur, the concept of a magistrate in Gaur, Henry Foster, the character?
This book has a creation myth, a very neat one that I can just sort of trot out, but it really did happen this way. I was reading, my brother and his beloved are great Boer War fans and Zulu War fans, any war in South Africa they like. And so I was reading something in the round about the Boer War. There's been some lovely books recently, Bunneling and Ephraimta and other ones like that. And I came across the story of a British general called General Sir Hector Macdonald, who was a Scots general, very, very, very successful and pretty rare for the time in that he wasn't born to it. He wasn't a nobleman. He came up from a working class and worked his way up the ranks to be this very successful general. Hugely resented by Kitchener. He was a better Kitchener and Gordon of Khartoum. None of those guys liked him terribly much. And he fought in the Boer War, and then he went off to Ceylon, where he was pretty dismissive of the tiny little British colonial society there, and they really didn't like him very much at all. And they very shortly were sending home dispatches about him being found in the company of boys. And I realized it always has to be boys, because you know, it's so easy to make the case that it's wrong if it's boys, but you can't make the case that easily if it's men. Anyway, these dispatches went home, and he was disgraced and recalled, and the king pretty much handed him a gun and said, do the honorable thing, which he crossed the channel to Paris, and in a hotel room he blew his brains out. And two things struck me about that story. Amazing to come across it. It's a really beautiful story, and a lot of people have written about it. In the writing of it, to this day there are people expending 50% of the energy of the book on trying to prove that he wasn't gay. So he lived his whole life. He was gay. He lived his whole life. And had sacrificed in a way, and then it was being denied by late historians. So the twisting of history is always very interesting, especially to South Africans, I think. And the other interesting thing was that before he went to Ceylon, he was said to have had, horror of horrors, a Boer prisoner of war as a lover. And that is just not your auntie's Boer War. And I thought, this is absolutely fascinating. And then I had this story, and from there it... almost through the mechanics of how the story would work. I wasn't that interested in a British general. I was very interested in the Boer prisoner of war. He became younger. His lover became younger. And his story started. And then it just, in sort of idle musings, worked out that someone who was a young man in the Boer War would have lived to see Afrikaner nationalism rise. And it just gripped me, that story. That's the one I told.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that answers my question, because it's a very interesting interaction between the historical setting and the kind of pressures that there would have been anyway, and then for someone who is in some way exceptional. Now, you know, the British general, of course, does crop up in your book, interestingly, almost as a footnote.
A wink from the universe of courage for Henry. Don't worry, you're not alone.
Yes, and Henry notes that, interestingly, that he was married and had children.
Yes, the wonder of it all. He had been married and had a son, which he had.
Nothing new under the sun.
No, well, I think that it wasn't that uncommon. Then Oscar Wilde was married and had two children. So
yeah, and also died in Paris, although didn't commit suicide.
Yeah. Wow.
So Henry was a kind of upwelling of history, if you like, but then he established himself as a character in his own right, very much so.
I have a terrible worthy streak, and it starts to sort of sketch these great parables about right and wrong in South Africa and stuff, and I have to fight that and try to make the story happen. I was hugely guided by my publisher in the front row in this, who's asking some acute questions in the early manuscript about why would he do this? Is this what's happening? Why does he disappear here and someone else comes up?
So
working hard to make him human. And I was a little bit in love with Henry at the end of things.
Yes, one senses that, but I think...
is that a bad thing if he...
No, I think authors fall in love with their characters. In group, do we fall in love? No. Okay.
No.
Okay.
It has to be someone you could never get.
Yeah.
Gay guy.
I was thinking about it this morning, was that someone said, well, she couldn't warm to my main character, and I felt almost as if she told me she couldn't warm to me.
Oh, you know,
because you invest so much of yourself. This doesn't mean you create characters that are necessarily admirable, but I think you do have to have, I'm sure Flaubert loved Madame Bovary, but yes. Hell, I mean, does he ever punish her? You know, that's, you know.
Yeah, but he really understands her. I mean, that's where he proper
love. Yeah, but
love
he punishes her for that.
Yeah, he does.
So I suppose, I mean, let's be original, call it a love-hate relationship. But
the one I love most in this book is the dread Mrs. Polly.
Yes, now that's interesting.
Dreadful woman.
You see, I think you handle that so well, the Adam Blancas. You don't call them that, but that's what they were called. Blikkiesdorp. And it would have been so easy just to make them only Adam and Blanc. But these are people who are scrabbling very hard for an existence, yeah. And you feel that what is here is, yes, it's a class division, but it's the haves and the have-nots. And very interestingly, you don't really go into race. I mean, that here, no. Class is prime. And then what I also... Sorry, I'm talking too much.
No.
Admired very much is your treatment of Johnny. Johnny is the boy who, in a way, seduces the magistrate.
He's amoral. And did you ever need someone amoral to walk into that story?
Absolutely. And he's on the make, but he's not just a hustler. I think what I liked about that was one sense that here is a boy who's grown up very poor, he's not known any affection, that he's also partly drawn to the affection. It's not just that...
Oh, he's feral, but he's like those lovely ginger toms who come to the back door. He's feral, but he will... And it means everything when you get love from a cat like that, I think. Yeah. The polies, the guy, the people, the poor whites living in Blikkiesdorp, almost an analogy within an analogy, because if the book is a lot about the rise of nationalism and it has to... understand that there was a survival impulse, imagined or real, in this. I don't mean imagined or real, I mean expropriated by politicians or real in this thing. The survivalists in the book are the polies and those like them. And they're so interesting, I find, people who will do anything to... When it's down to brass knuckles how do you feed your children?
Yes, again, I don't know why I'm thinking of Ellen Payton again, but in Too Late, the Feller Rope, the woman betrays the policeman, sleeps with her, because someone has threatened to take away her child. Mm. So you feel this is someone driven to such an extreme that she'll do anything. And you feel with Mrs. Polly, when she comes and she basically blackmails the magistrate, she needs the money.
Yeah, the magistrate understands that there's a survival impulse here, and that he's almost being invited to participate in her survival. Mm. He's a bit wishy-washy. He's definitely of my mindset of wanting to do the right thing, but like really wishy-washy. Bloody liberals. And he almost understands why she's doing that.
Yeah. No, I mean, he is an exceptional person, and I don't mean unbelievable, but...
Well, I think the part that he won't understand and he can't get past is the part that assumes that being who he is makes him worthy of punishment. That's where he stops. That's where the real hurt comes, that something so deep in him has made him someone excluded from grace. That he is the one...
You mean he feels excluded by virtue of what he knows himself to be.
Yes, what he knows himself to be.
And yet he is, from the start, revered by, as this beautiful young man, and then as the magistrate.
He's superb. The Boers love him on commando. He looks right. He's in the propaganda films of the time. Mm. And they were something, those propaganda films. And you can find them.
I wanted to ask you about the propaganda
films. Watch them. Yeah. That one that is described is an actual propaganda film.
The young Boer saddling up.
No. The one, the sneaky Boer. Was filmed in the Yellow Hills of Lincolnshire.
Blackburn, Lancashire.
Yeah, and they have this British you know, this noble Tommy standing on guard and ting, 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 out of comes the sneaky boer.
And the other one of the young boer was your...
No, that was just imagination. Okay, yeah. So he gets... The boers love him. He's on commando. He's just superb. The British, when they start to impose or to start to introduce a quota system to make Milner's hell more easily palatable for everyone, to make his exit, I think, a bit easier. Anyway, they start handing over and they start... encouraging him to be like them, you know, we'll raise this Afrikaans guy to be a British gentleman, and then he gets a job through a quota system, through affirmative action. He gets the magistrate of Gower.
Yes, that is interesting. I mean, if one, since we're back in a quota system, that Henry, the way that the sort of incumbent magistrates and so on talk of Afrikaners, say, well, lots of them are now, you know, coming in, that there is this quota. Yeah. And there clearly is a kind of contempt there. But he's okay. I mean, they're sort of quite surprised that Henry is educated.
Yeah, I don't know which would be more galling. Milner's lot saying, you're not cutting it, or Milner's lot saying, no, you're doing okay.
For an Afrikaner.
For an Afrikaner, yeah. And that sneery thing, which my tribe is so very good at, it had to be in the book, so there it is.
Yeah, it's quite strong also, of course, in Ceylon with the awful, what's her name?
Oh, Sayela Ufit.
Now, where do you get a name like Sayela Ufit?
I'm reading lots of
C-Y-E-L-L-A. Sayela. Ufit, O-F-I-T.
Those are real names from the world.
I was wondering.
And in fact, she first came with a photograph. I trawled thousands and thousands of photographs, and I literally found one of this heavy-jawed woman, youngish woman, trying to look pretty and be loved, and she just wasn't, and she hated the whole world.
You do sense that somewhere there is something to be pitied there, but at the same time, there's a lot there to be very scared of.
If we're speaking very obscurely, sorry, chaps, in the prisoner of war camp on Ceylon, young Henry is given parole to accompany the Sayela Ufit out on outrides, because you can't ride among the natives by yourself. So he rides with her, and that frees him from the camp. And, of course, sets up a very important image for the book. He's constrained, he's free, he's constrained, he's free.
Oh, yes,
that's my favorite part of the book.
It's your,
because it's all subtropics and love.
And this beautiful young monk in orange robes. Spoil it for me.
Well, it's happened that the love happened so early in the book. Yes. I don't think we're spoiling it.
It is very idyllic, I must say. I admired the way in which you don't... I was dreading all the way through. Are we going to have this absolute catastrophe? Again, as in... Too Late the Fellow Rope, where the policeman is caught and he is disgraced and he is thrown out of the community. And now, sorry to spoil it, but it doesn't quite happen like that. You know, that of course there is a change. He is in a way demoted, but not in... it's not the kind of total calamity that one has in...
There were a couple of texts that informed this. Not texts, you know, huge in the grand way, because I'm sort of feeling my way in this writing thing. But one of the things that I've loved since I was a kid and read it, and it stayed with me, and it answers your question. Herman Charles Bosman, it's in Cold Stone Jug that he writes about this, and he was imprisoned in Pretoria Central, and then he was let out after, I think, 2 years or something, to go and put up a notice board outside the main gate. So he would come out of the warder's gate, walk about 100 meters, put up the thing. And he'd been imagining, what will the world be like? It will be so bright and so beautiful. There'll be greenery and flowers and women and trees. And he goes out and he walks, and a woman walks past him, and he puts up the thing and he goes back, and he's completely hollowed out and undone by the subtlety of what he saw, by the pastels and the small ways the light shifts. And you have no defense against subtlety. You can fight nationalism, bold colors when they come, but it's the subtlety that'll get you every time. I'm not interested in him being tarred and feathered and driven out of the city or the town. It's much more interesting to me if the disgrace is internal, hidden, of his own volition, all those other ways. It's a bit... it's going to get me into such trouble one day, and maybe this is the day. But race in South Africa can't... it isn't subtle enough yet. Or the way we fight about it is in such a blunt way that it doesn't feel.
Well, it could be a challenge, and perhaps someone can tell me whether perhaps it's been done. But I know what you're saying is that we conceive of it very much in terms of a confrontation or something, that rather than these are just people living together and there are certain tensions and there are certain attractions.
And some tensions are attributable to these great sort of monolithic visions we have of each other, and some are not.
Which right at this moment is such a polarization that it's really difficult to...
It's almost like an old dance. We all move towards each other, up into each other's faces, and soon we'll just minuet back a bit. Boy, sorry for derailing it.
No. You know, obviously you've done so much research. I went in the best possible way, and I never feel that we're just having research thrown at us, as one sometimes does in reading.
We've buried in the texts quite deliberately of the hardcover a really bad error.
You did what? Sorry,
there's an error buried, like an Easter egg hunt. I know you got it. Maybe everyone else won't get it.
Okay. Well, I had some real
time. So much for research, there's a mistake.
But... that's just the only one that I noticed. But I've also tried to write historical novels, and it's a problem I have, and I just want to know how you feel about it, that you're never quite sure what's driving your narrative. Is it the research, or are you writing a story that you have in your mind and then you do research to sort of back it up?
It's the oddest thing. I mean, and to try to explain to someone who hasn't been through that, because they're both happening at the same time, but you're very aware when one's in the lead and one's not in the lead. Yeah. Recently, I sort of had rushed into writing this third book that I'm busy with, and there were certain assumptions I made about a certain place, and I just wrote them because it would fit the story. And I went recently to that place and drove on the route, and it was all confirmed. It could have happened that way, and those things were indeed there. The things I needed for the book were in the real world. And I had that very strange mixed reaction that you have, as, oh, great, that's cool, tick that off. But also, it wasn't just imagined, it was actually there. It's like... Bloody Earth's plagiarized my description. I don't know. It's a strange thing, isn't it? So you don't know.
Life following art, you know.
So you can pat yourself on the back and say, what a clever thing to have guessed it that way. But I would rather have guessed it and it wasn't quite that way. I don't know. Maybe it's like surrendering of control if you're doing
that. But would it have mattered if the town looked completely different? Because
No, I would have liked it more if it had looked completely different and I'd made it bent it to my will.
So this Gowrie is based on an actual town?
No, it's based on three or four different towns.
Okay, right.
But it's in an actual place. It's near Jamestown, which does exist.
Okay,
bottom of Lesotho.
Okay, right.
Just in the Free State.
Of course, we have a Jamestown out here between
Stellenbosch
and Somerset West.
But it's not that Jamestown.
It's a very different Jamestown. Yes. So you felt there was a kind of interaction?
So there is, I think... If you do come across in your research something that's so great that you have to put it in just because you love the fact and that you have to bend the narrative to do it, you have to be so careful.
You have to be careful.
Because it's very apparent. And it might well be apparent in The Magistrate of Gower where I've done that.
It can show.
Yeah.
I know when I wrote a novel which was based on the life of Henry James, and I included a couple of things that people said to me, why did you include this? Yeah. And I said, well, just because it happened. And that's the worst reason to put anything into a novel, I think, is because it happened.
Yeah, or because I can.
Yeah.
Because I'm somehow doing... You take the reader off the track of the book and the trust that you've established to quickly do a little, you know, soft shoe shuffle because you've just learned how to do a soft shoe shuffle.
Yeah, yeah,
it's not good. Shall I ask you where it was that it's quite apparent in this? Because I know... It's in the British period, in the middle period, isn't it?
You're talking about God? You want me to guess where?
Well, yeah.
No, I don't know. I mean, I assume
it's not happened at all.
I don't actually know places like Carnarvon and so on, but I assume it's something, Carnarvon, Sutherland, something like that, just because of the names that you mentioned.
Do I mention those in the thing? Because that's where Gower comes from.
I heard you at the open book saying there was an Earl of Gower.
There's a Carnarvon, Sutherland, Wellington. No, not Wellington. Carnarvon, Sutherland, someone else, and Gower.
Yeah.
And we had three of the four.
We had three of them.
Yeah.
So I assumed that the town was something like that.
Yes, it's exactly. And it was when the British were deciding, okay, we're going to impose our great map and red crayon on this country, and they sort of established these towns all over the place, that were very quickly stopped being British towns and started being the towns of people descended from the Dutch. So the water furrows are...
But you make the point here that... Ah, yes, here we are. Another... They established this town. Another would be built north or northwest of this one and named like its noble brother, Carnarvon, Worcester, Sutherland, Gower. And over time, we fitted with a steeple, trees, a main street whose shops faced one another across a street almost too wide for hailing. They must run out somewhere, these towns, but from here it seems as though they repeat like a pattern on a vast belt of cloth all the way to the Vaal. So Gower is a representative example of a particular kind. And this is what one feels. Of course, it's been spoilt by pep stores and these things. But
it's incredible to see those old, beautiful facades with a bank of neon just slapped across them.
Yes. Mm. No, I mean, the sort of semi-urban ugliness that has overtaken small towns.
But I love the way a whole school of South African painters have started loving that urban ugliness.
Yes. Well, yeah.
John Cramer and those.
I was thinking of Cramer, and
Willem.
And what's Boshoff. His name?
Willem Boshoff? Willem.
No, it'll come to me. Anyway, I'll think of it. That kind of photorealist rendering of shop fronts.
Yeah, and being and insisting Bolton on the right Meyer to admire and love and find beauty in it, even though it's because it's ours.
Right. So, is Henry? I'm still interested in this thing of Henry Fort as an insider-outsider. When you seem to see him as central to his character, the fact that he feels himself outside, though, although he is seen as inside. I mean, does he feel a fraud?
He feels superior to the people he's around. That is one of the things. And I think when he decides to make a life for himself, setting up home with his sister, that he has somehow successfully negotiated this thing. Mm. I don't think the fraud part comes into it. He is as he is, and the world is as he finds it, and now he's going to make a plan for how
I think another very refreshing thing about your novel is he's not racked with guilt. I mean, he isn't, oh my God, what am I? You know.
I think part of being the product of such a sunlit childhood where you're the favorite child and the beautiful one is that you're not going to be like that. Whatever else you have those very basic things we all have, is how you were raised, where you were in the structure of the family.
But I think for a gay man, even now, but obviously much more so then, to grow up is a very difficult process of placing yourself in relation to a society that you think is going to reject you if they were to know. Now, Henry doesn't seem to feel that...
I hope that... because he wouldn't have known of many men like him, especially as a boy growing up, that he would not see it as... it wouldn't have been hugely spoken about when he was growing up, and not as a shameful thing. He would have picked up that one ought not to be like this. Well, but there wasn't an underworld or a subculture of shame that he could slip into or find identity in at all.
You make the point at one stage, I think it's with Prem, the young monk, that they had no name for what they were doing.
Yeah.
It almost makes me think I've been reading about the Greeks. They say that the Greeks had no name for same-sex intercourse because it's what they did.
Yeah.
You know that. So we, of course, have labels and people see themselves in terms of those labels. And any young man growing up here will have heard about Morpheus.
Yes,
the first thing he heard. Yeah.
And he would have heard it before he was in a way rescued by his own natural urges. Mm. Henry is... lots of us are redeemed by, I think, by our human nature.
Yes, I think the subtlety is that he gets drawn into this relationship before he has any notion of what it is. I mean, in other words, it's unmediated by society.
And it happens very, not terribly subtly, It happens in Eden. It's yes. before the fall. He has before the fall, then he has a fall, and now we have the interesting, much more sere part. The landscape of the book is lushly subtropical. It's in the highlands of Ceylon among the tea plantations. Then it's back in Cape Town, the family farm, the sort of silly 20s, and then this throat closing dry, which is my experience of living under Afrikaner nationalism. The dryness, not being able to express anything.
I think you've mentioned this before. I just want to go back to it. That I sense that those dates, 1901, 1948, you were tracking the rise of Afrikaner nationalism. It's much more subtle once again than that. But is that why you chose those particular dates? Yeah.
Yes, and it really is stretched to get 48 in. And I don't know.
Jump 10 years
ago. Yeah,
if I
did it again, I'm not sure I would. I just leave it. You don't have to hit it over the head saying it would come to pass. It's clearly coming to pass in most of the book.
Well, you don't actually spell it out. We don't. We know it's 1948, and of course 1948 reverberates in our minds, but you don't actually. Insist on it.
Well, by then, who is the main character of the book has been swapped halfway through.
Yes.
And the person who's now the main character of the book is left reflecting. She's lived through watching things come to pass, and she's in some way armored against what's coming because of what she's gone through. But I think I said briefly in correspondence before today, the mother in the children's day, your book. Something that struck me, it's a small thing, it might have sort of flown by you. She comes back from a Frau Federasi meeting, and the husband says something, and she just says something a little bit cool and distant, but not dismissive or ugly or anything, about the meeting or about one of the people there. And that just stayed with me, and that whole Thrawn family in the Magistrate of Gaur comes from her.
Wonderful.
There you go. It's your fault.
Okay. No, I'm very flattered. No, I think that the mother in that book, in the children's day, is seen as someone who is not a rebel, but who very quietly has her reservations about what's...
Yeah.
I know. She's based on my mother, and my mother once said to me, she goes to church, and she goes along with the geloofsbelijdenis. She says, that's a secret deal of art, but it's still blay. You don't say anything. You just don't go along with
what. But everyone's like that today as well. There's just, before you are this great political being, you're still someone who has to go to church on Sunday and see their friends.
The two points I want to take up there. One is the sister, Anna, who is a very important figure in his life at first. She is also... She's attracted to the city. She has a kind of empathetic bond with Henry. She goes to the city with him. And then the farmer comes and claims her, and she disappears basically from the novel. Was that sort of deliberate to... perhaps along the lines of the Olive Schreiner recollection that you also sort of use in your book, that the fate of a woman who has other interests, other... abilities, perhaps, then I don't want to say relapsing, but certainly going back in time to a previous kind of dispensation, because she becomes Frauenmutter at the end.
I didn't see her as a great feminist hero at all, or a hugely talented or skilled person. She was just someone who had to make a life for herself, who had to survive somehow. Was a little bit brighter than maybe, or more ambitious than the family she'd born into, and had to escape it. And mainly she was there, Anna, to be Henry's attempt at passing for straight.
Okay, so she's what we nowadays call a beard.
She's a beard. And then she had to leave the story, so she does. Whoops, seeing behind the great curtain of Oz.
No, but I thought it was very poignant, this young woman who, comes to Cape Town and all of a sudden...
And she's not entirely reconciled to her fate, but she knows... Mm-hmm. It's almost like she knows that is what she has to do. She has to marry and have children. I've been reflecting a lot on sexism versus racism recently.
On what?
Sexism versus racism, because... people are talking about economic emancipation not following political emancipation in South Africa, and I'm just thinking, well, speak to the women about how it's been like 80 years that we've had political power and we're still not economically emancipated. Anyway, and then you have to come round to reflecting that for the good, for the survival of the species and for all these other reasons, sexism is different from racism in that you are locked together. The sexism thing has to be worked out somehow that way. And again, she's not the first woman in the world to have to give up a different life because of the cause of biology. She wants to have babies. Yeah.
But it's interesting here that it's almost as if the country comes to claim her in that, you know, the farmer comes into Cape Town, then takes her
into Gower.
But again,
yes, he's almost summoned by the Thrawn family, almost summons him to find her waiting.
Yes.
I fought quite hard. I don't know if I won. And when we were editing it, he comes and finds her waiting for him. It's the first time they meet, the farmer and Anna.
Okay, right.
You get down the rabbit hole with that phrase. So I'm with any phrase.
While we're talking about the female characters, I mean, there is, of course, the redoubtable Mrs. Polly.
Do you know where that surname comes from?
No, do tell.
Guess what Louis Late's born name was?
Polly?
Polly. Oh.
Louis Late.
Okay. And I happened to be, there was some genankness to do with him, and I happened to hear it on the radio. What a great name.
And what did you think that, what's the connection between Louis Late and Mrs. Polly?
None. Louis Late was born very poor, wrapped in newspapers as an infant. So it was that story, the rags to riches story, but just that name leapt out. It's so beautiful. Poles apart, polecat, Polly. It doesn't.
Yeah,
it's not.
Because you wonder,
it's not beating you over the head. Dutch origin. It's just a great name.
No, you do wonder about the origin of the name. You say you got many of the other names from.
Well, you know, there were a lot of Scottish people. There were lots of people stayed behind after the Boer War. Yeah. It was a great mix. Yeah. It is my great delight to go wandering and plundering for names. In the block, sort of a block away from my home in Simonstown, is a place called the Old Burying Ground. Mm. And the first place I walk through is the Boer War memorial part. And it's almost, on one side, there are all the fallen commandos and things, heavily Dutch and Huguenot names. Mm. And on the other side, it's the Dutch and Huguenot women who've married Scotsmen. Okay. And they've died. And this is a mixing. And and everyone, biology has found a way through dogma. And, and they started mixing. So a lot of the people in the book, Henry's mother is a Scotsman. She's an Afrikaans woman, but she's of Scots ancestry. Yeah.
The farm name, where does that come from?
I forget what it is.
Name of the farm is... I thought it was a Scottish name, but...
It is. It is a Scottish name. Sorry, I got ridiculous that I can't remember.
Something very...
Craigievar.
Craigievar.
It's a good Scots name.
And then on names and on the central women in the novel, why, as you say, another character sort of almost takes over the story,
Adera.
Adera.
Van Brugge.
In the first, why? I mean, it's just interesting to me as a literary technique that from the start, this is announced as a story that was told to Adera. Did you feel you needed her as another perspective? Or, I'm not saying she's unnecessary. I'm just wondering.
No. I wondered if that wasn't me failing to tell his story without me somehow being in it. Or I don't know what it was, but she did that thing, that sounds like such nonsense whenever you talk about it, a character arriving and demanding to be heard.
Yeah.
He had to have a partner. He had to have someone who knew him, and who understood. And she just grew and rather took over. And that might well have been. I mean, I've watched in my sort of professional life in newspapers, people hire in their own image, and maybe you write in your own image as well, whatever you're writing.
So she becomes a kind of surrogate for yourself in the novel. I'm oversimplifying now, but No, it's interesting because I also
it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I like that device of a, well, what Henry James would have called a central consciousness. It's not, she's not the controlling consciousness here, is she? But she, you revert to her all the time.
Yes, and I like very much that she's completely self-obsessed and she's going through her own little moral crises and yes. making her own way and also thinks yeah. she's also clever. Yeah. And then her big awakening is to realize that there was a whole other world yeah. going on. Yeah. And a lot of the book is about imagining... about imagining the other, the enemy or whatever. I have a theory that if you imagine someone in the act of love, or in, you can't hate them. If you imagine the real humanity, the most human acts of people, that you can't despise them as a type anymore. And so one of our defenses against nationalism is to imagine humanity in other people, and she's made to do that in the end. She realizes yeah. that.
You make a point at some stage that Henry is the bane of the existence of his colleagues in the office because he had this exasperating habit of being able to see things from more than one point of view,
yes.
which wastes time in
waste
a
time
in a bureaucracy.
And especially you're building an empire here, chaps yeah, together, yeah, all yeah, on the so, same page, mm-hmm, please.
Yeah. And I found it interesting too that you, sorry, now I'm, I hope this is not a spoiler, but that she is the one who sort of imagines the events in Henry's life at the end.
Yeah, she's becoming a writer towards yeah. the end, so maybe it is exactly a proxy for me. Yeah, I'm baffled about that part.
So, yeah, you were saying earlier she takes over, as it were.
She takes over and then she performs an act of imagination, which is such an act of generosity as well. It's the beginning of compassion and of understanding in herself as well, to imagine how things really work in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's quite optimistic how she thinks they really work in the world.
Yes, yes, because what she imagines is an act of generosity, one might say.
Yeah, I guess it's, kindness.
Kindness. Where one would not have expected. Sorry, we're being very cryptic here because we don't want to spoil the story for you. But
and the book is kind of, it's very much about South Africa today, which is really for myself. It's not overtly like that at all. But you do, not even today, because this was, you know, the way books take forever to get made. It was about 2 years ago before fees must fall and all that stuff. But there were people were starting to make nationalist sounds again against who's in and who's out and who are the one and who are the others. Mm. And just because we find ourselves being the others, you can still recognize the wrongness in the thing. And I was almost asking, what is the reaction of the reasonable person when that is going on around you? How do you deal with it? What ought your moral or... your reaction to be, and the conclusion is just retreat to the personal and be good.
It's as basic as that.
Be kind. No, it's not emigrate.
No,
my goodness.
No, a sentence I underlined in the book was towards the end, Henry thinking, it is an endless imposition, he thinks, to live in a country that is in the process of inventing itself, as his has been since he was a child in the Oranje Freistaat. And of course, as it still is, we're still inventing ourselves. I mean, the country is all the time inventing itself and having to come up with a plausible sort of form of invention.
And you never know what you think in this country because it's always changing.
Listen, I think we can give the audience an opportunity to chip in.
Or I could spring something on you, and it really has only just occurred to me now.
A spring?
Yeah. I kept looking for a poem, and when I write, I have to read poetry to start off, because it sort of resets your brain or something. And I kept looking for the poem that would say what I was saying, and then Furi will attest to this. I think he had just pushed the button on some printing press in India somewhere to start this thing rolling off, and I said, I've found the poem, and it's Dear Opperman, and it's fantastic, and it is the poem that talks about, uncannily talks about this. Now, I guess there will be some of you in the audience who have read the book and some who haven't. I don't think it matters either way. If by a show of hands we can get Michiel to read this poem.
Do you want to read it?
My Afrikaans. I'll try, but it's
well, okay.
Bad.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to be coy, but I'm happy to do it. But I don't want to. Anyway, Yuri.
I really was going to ask you to, but we'll see. Shall okay. I try? And,
try.
And what if I do Skada on Ital?
I don't think it. I don't think anyone will hold it against you if you're.
Okay, but just listen to this.
Yeah.
Okay, it's Dichter by D.J. Opperman. Dichter. Ek is gevang en met die stryd ergens in die ewigheid op 'n salon verban. Waar al my drange na 'n verlore vaderland my dag na dag geëiland hou met horisonne en verlange. En in die geel gloed van die kers, snags deur die smal poort van die wonder, elke woord laat skik tot kleinste lasies vers, wat groei tot boeg en mas en takelwerk, en die uiteindelike reis met die klein skip geslote agter glas.
Oh, yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
A man in isolation.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful.
And may I say that this poem's provenance was tracked down by someone who may or may not be in the audience today, who I will not single out, but I will say thank you, Mrs. Dupria, if you are here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I was wondering about this. I'm not just asking because I feel obliged to ask. Writing about South African history and you having mentioned how bizarre it sometimes feels to live in a country that's reinventing itself continually, where do you find your moral compass and who has the right to tell to tell the story,
and to tell whose stories as
and
well.
And who tell whose stories, and which stories are the right ones to tell.
With The Spiral House, my first book, which is a lot about a young freed slave who goes back to a slave plantation, I was very new to the whole book world, and you know yourself, it's a different thing from journalism, where we both come from, where we're able to scale achter. And on a panel like this in Johannesburg, a young coloured woman, her race is relevant, said, well, she was actually quite angry about, it wasn't rude enough to say it directly about me, but about people who take other people's stories and tell them and who appropriate other people's stories. And I was, of course, mortified, terrified, all that stuff. And then afterwards I thought, absolutely not. I mean, the reason I changed from journalism to fiction is that no one tells me what to write. And I had my little Biko moment, I write what I like kind of thing. It's all very well to say that, but I am so conscious that it's not my story in a way. And I both want to insist on the right to try to tell it and greatly fear someone saying, how very dare you say that. So I don't know what the answer is. And the moral compass thing, we're not solving stuff, we're just describing stuff in the hope, you know, just putting it out there. But I also personally believe, and it comes out very strongly in this book as well, that in the face of that kind of, any kind of great sweeping political movement that makes you feel terribly uneasy, which just keeps happening again and again in this country, that you'd really do, as chicken as it sounds, retreat to the personal and be kind. It's about one-on-one stories, but that's my thing. That's why English liberals will never prevail. We don't have any flags. We don't march. We just say, be nice. Yeah. I don't know if that answers it. And the stories, oh boy, they're everywhere, those stories. But I'm very conscious. I think I'd say to Fari, or might have been to Beth, the next book, that's one, the one that's come sweeping in, it's about my lot. And my lot are quite interesting. We're very good at pretending we're good. Woo.
So they're English-speaking, colonial British, are they?
Victorian Natal.
Natal, yeah. Okay.
And I love it.
You're quite tough on them in this book. Are you going to be tough on
who?
Them?
The
well, on the English, yes.
Yoh, we don't have the best history. Well, yeah. They. It's a weird thing. That's what interests me, is we're all of us, well, especially my tribe, is standing there like a toddler at the foot of Africa, shaking its little fist at Europe and saying, you are not the boss of me. And what do you think, how do you think I'm doing? It's a cultural cringe and all that stuff. Quite tough on you, but we're all... Anyway, our lot.
Any other questions?
Yeah, most writers start publishing in their 20s or 30s. And you sort of land on the stage fully formed. How come that happened?
Why I started so late? I had to raise my babies and support them.
I don't have that excuse.
And put Cocoa Pops on the table, and you're not going to support. I really was very conscious of having to raise my girls, and I really started writing when the youngest went off to varsity. So.
And what did you do before that with your imagination?
I stuck to the facts. I worked as a reporter for years and years, which okay. took care of the writing part completely. And the and it really was. I came by stages to this, but the stages were, you could see in hindsight, heading this way because they were. I stopped reporting. I said, I'm not going to write what anyone else wants me to write anymore. It started to feel like a dwindling resource that I had to save it from reportage and having the stuff subbed and stuff. And so I went into the sub-editing side of things, which is great. You're just messing up someone else's words. and then tried this. But we did figure out, standing outside, that I'm not the oldest person ever to have published a first novel in South Africa.
No, I think I've got the record there. Well, I don't know.
Started late. Yeah. Took my.
I've just been given a signal from the back there okay. that we should.
Okay. I just want to say it's not that you've started so late, but that you've managed to
not do it for so long.
No, just to do it so well.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, there seems to be no prior process of stumbling and finding your voice. Yeah. That's what I meant to say, that it's as if you found your voice and there it was. Yeah.
Faree has a phrase, Karen, you may have heard from him. So he says, you're writing fit. Because you've done it your whole life, it's a language almost. I mean, that sounds so silly, but it really is a facility that you have with. So you a whole stage of that process, I think, is taken care of by a long apprenticeship of doing it daily to earn your bread.
Take your word for it. Hmm? I'll take your word for it.
Thanks, everybody. We have to wrap up
Thanks, guys.